Time to check in with our regular night's economic pundit, Dr. Eric Crampton, who is the chief economist at the free market think tank, the New Zealand Initiative. And first up tonight, he wants to explore some of the less well-canvassed aspects of the new government's coalition agreements. And then he's keen to talk about what he believes could play a big part in the New Zealand path to net zero emissions. So let's get started. Kia ora, Eric. Thanks for joining us here on Night.
Good evening. Great to be here.
Good on you. Nice to chat with you again. And, well, I assume with this topic, you've been poring over the agreements, the coalition agreements, and this week or last week, what are your first reactions?
Well, it's always fun going over these when you're at a think tank because you spend a decade doing work on policies that you think will matter for improving growth and making the country a better place as we see it. And you're always looking to see whether anything that you've been advocating shows up and what other surprises might be in there. So some bits of the coalition agreements have been fairly well canvassed and have gotten a fair bit of heat already in public discussion. I thought it might go through some of the other bits that haven't gotten quite as much play. Sort of first off the rank, we're pretty happy to see that the coalition agreement has room for incentive payments for council growth. So in prior conversations on Nights back with Brian, when he was in, we'd often talk about New Zealand's housing shortages. Mm-hmm. Our shop has been of the view that it comes down to poor incentives facing councils, that councils set rules that make it hard for developers to build up and to build out, because when councils facilitate growth and enable more housing, central government gets most of the benefit from that. They get the extra income tax revenue, they get the extra GST, they get the extra company tax revenue, and councils are largely left with a bill that they have a hard time affording to pay to upgrade infrastructure, mm. and not much left over to try and deal with people who don't like more buildings next to them. Mm. So the coalition agreement has room for this. We're going to see it. It's in the agreement, so that's great. Quite what form it'll take is a bit up in the air yet. National had previously talked about just straight cash payments to councils. The ACT Party coalition agreement instead has potential consideration of just transfers that are benchmarked to GST revenues from new construction. Either way, councils will get stronger positive incentive to welcome more housing development. And if we want to get out of a housing crisis, that's a pretty good first step. Make councils more welcoming of growth because it positively affects their bottom line rather than just being a cost. So we were pretty happy to see that show up in the coalition agreements. Mm.
Is there a return to sort of more standard public policy, would you suggest?
Well, there is. So if we go beyond the particular policies that are highlighted in the coalition agreements, they also have a set of ongoing decision-making principles. And that's kind of fun because you can't specify all of the policies you might undertake over the next 3 years because life comes at you fast, right? So they've committed to a set of principles that look a lot more like how Treasury acted in the 2000s, really. So I'm a bit of a policy geek. Normal drill in policy analysis is that you start by really closely defining what the problem is that you think you're trying to solve, mm. and then working from there to figure out what options are going to be most effective and most cost effective for solving it. More recently, we've seen problem definitions in regulatory impact analysis that'll say something as lame as the minister wants policy X. And that's not much of a policy problem. That's a political problem. It shouldn't show up in regulatory impact assessment. So they've gone back to more standard problem definition. They've emphasized rigorous cost benefit analysis and economic efficiency. So over the past 6 years or so, Treasury has been shifting from more standard economic cost benefit assessment with an emphasis on efficiency as a norm to, well, what Treasury has called the well-being framework. I think that they had set that up under the prior national government to give them a language that might work better for talking with labor, mm-hmm. but it also didn't seem that conducive to rigorous policy assessment. So we're pretty happy that it's going back to a more standard economic efficiency, rigorous cost-benefit assessment. And of course, cost-benefit assessment can be very broad. All kinds of values can come in that assessment, but you have to be rigorous about it. There's more than a few things that show up in the policy agreements in the coalition deals that we might have a hard time meeting those standards, but at least policy going forward is going to have to hit those. And if they don't, like, it's a free hit for the opposition, right? So Labour or the Greens could come in, or Te Pāti Māori, saying, well, you're pitching policy X now, and you promised that you're going to have rigorous cost-benefit assessment, and this obviously fails it. So what's going on? You promised your coalition partners that you'd be having cost-benefit assessment, right? They've given a rod for everybody else to beat them with if they deviate, and that's pretty useful.
Yeah. Do you think there'll be the same opposition from councils and residents groups that were opposed to Labour's policy?
Well, until you change the incentives facing councils, you're going to have a hard time changing the game. What we had really hoped would come out of things like incentive payments to councils is that they would give councils room to make deals. So I've attended a few of these sort of town hall meetings that you have when councils will propose an upzoning. You'll have local residents that don't want to see much change. But sometimes there are really legitimate concerns that come in about community facilities that might be overcrowded, local parks that would need an upgrade. And council just doesn't really seem to have the room to be able to upgrade those amenities. You're missing out on decent win-win scenarios where the extra revenue that would be coming from the new development should give enough surplus to be able to upgrade some of those facilities so everybody's better off, with central government giving some of the benefits of that growth back down to council. There should be more room for councils to strike deals that avoid these kinds of ways of blocking growth.
Now, are there big changes coming for the Commerce Commission?
Yeah, that was another one that we've been pretty happy about. So we've had prior nights conversations about competition in retail grocery and the Commerce Commission's market studies processes. The Commerce Commission, it's a fairly new power that they've had, these market studies. It allows them to go into areas where they're not really looking out for a cartel necessarily. They're just looking to see whether the conditions for competition are as strong as they could be. And they take a fairly broad analysis over that. In the supermarket study, it became obvious pretty quickly that the main problem was that councils haven't zoned enough land for supermarkets, and that consenting can take anywhere from a year to a decade. So any new entrants is going to have a nightmare trying to figure out where they're allowed to build anything. And that basically makes it illegal to open up a new large footprint supermarket chain. We saw similar issues show up in the building material supply market study, where it's difficult to use new building materials to get them over the regulatory line. Councils can be nervous about using them because of joint and several liability. But all of these have been really high cost processes for the Commerce Commission. They spend a year or more coming up with these giant reports that get into really fine grained detail. And bits of that fine grained detail turn really contentious, and it's hard to get them right. And really, if you just spend a couple of months looking at it, saying, would it actually be legal for Aldi or Lidl or Tesco or a new New Zealand entrant to open a large-scale set of supermarkets across the country? Like, would it be possible for them to do that? Let's just think through what they would have to do, what the regulatory barriers would be, and whether it's even possible. As soon as you saw that it was effectively illegal to open up a new set of supermarkets, well, you could just stop there and start encouraging government to make it legal to have competition. There are all kinds of areas where it seems fraught with this. Medical services in particular. So it's very difficult for new doctors to come in and be certified. I think we're in this crazy spot where we've got a shortage of doctors, but if a Canadian GP in good standing with the Canadian Medical Association and the College of Physicians up there, if that GP was, say that you're 50 and you're in Northern Canada and it's just miserable in winter, and you and your friend wanted to come to New Zealand, maybe go to the Wairarapa, it's wine country, it's gorgeous, open a shared clinic where you have to each go part-time, that's like paradise, right? But it's illegal. You'd have to go and find some GP in New Zealand who'd be willing to supervise you for a year first. And there's no good reason for that. A GP that's good enough to practice there is good enough to practice here. Market studies looking at that would be great. It was also good to see in the coalition agreement that they want to take a more direct look at opening things up for foreign medical practitioners to operate here. So it'd be awesome to see the Commerce Commission really be able to go after those kinds of restrictions on competition, where government just makes it far too hard for new competitors to come in and provide benefits for New Zealand consumers.
What about rule changes around personal grievances?
Yeah, so these are some of the areas that we were suggesting haven't had much play yet. We keep talking about New Zealand's long tail of low productivity firms and our ongoing productivity issues. If you look at it, it's almost impossible for a company to fire an underperforming manager. Like if you get somebody who's fairly high tier and they're underperforming, that has consequences all the way down through the firm. It's terrible for the people they're supervising. It's terrible for the company, for the customers, for the shareholders. It's not really good for anybody. And a lot of the employment protections that we have in employment law are really there to address power imbalances between like an employer and a low-wage worker who has fewer options. If you're talking about people who are on sort of managerial salaries, 150,000 a year and up, you don't really think that they're in the same spot as somebody who might be on $50,000 a year, or at least not as much as in need of protection. So the coalition agreement has suggested, and this is something that we've put in submissions on before and written little reports on, that high salary earners should not have access to personal grievance procedures that wind up making it effectively impossible to fire underperforming managers. They require instead that you basically pay the guys off to make them go away. It will make everything run more smoothly and hopefully help firms become more productive and better for the people who've been stuck under underperforming managers.
But that is that likely then to cover some and not other employees, though? Is it going to be balanced and fair?
It'll be anyone on a salary threshold. So if you're on high salary, then you would no longer have access to personal grievance procedures. If you're on lower salaries, then you still have a standard drill.
Now, the other thing, I'm intrigued in your notes about medicines
Yeah,
and
this one was pretty.
cold medicines,
Yeah, go ahead.
particularly.
Yeah, I think this is another one that we've talked about on nights before, where I've argued that it's just hard to see how MedSafe actually protects us from when medicines have already been approved by at least two overseas agencies. I've heard a lot of Kiwis say, well, we can't trust the FDA, or they get nervous about that. In any of the academic literature I've seen on this, every one of these agencies errs on the side of being too cautious about releasing drugs because, of course, any one of these approval agencies, they're always balancing two kinds of ways that they can screw up. They can screw up by taking too long to release a drug that's actually safe, or they can screw up by being too quick to release a drug that isn't safe. And because agency officials are more likely to be fired for releasing a bad drug than failing to release a good drug, they all wind up erring on the side of caution. If two of them, like the FDA and the European Medical Agency, or the European Medicines Agency, or the Canadians and the British, or the Australians and the Swiss, if they both have authorized the medicine, we've argued in a policy report and in, well, in ongoing commentary that it should just automatically be legal here, along with a fail-safe for MedSafe in case they were worried, particularly worried about one. And that one's shown up in the coalition agreement. We're very happy about that. It will mean that MedSafe will have to approve new medicines within a month of their having been approved by a second trustworthy overseas agency. We can take one simple example just in the past month, right? Wegovy is a version of semaglutide that's used for weight loss. It's been approved overseas for at least a year by at least two agencies. It's longer than a year now. There's been no application in New Zealand yet. In August, MedSafe withdrew about 20 different drugs from consideration for, sorry, Pharmac withdrew about 20 different drugs from consideration to see whether they were cost effective or not, because they saw no prospect of MedSafe evaluating them. Nobody was putting them up for MedSafe certification. The problem isn't so much that MedSafe is slow, even though they really are slow, the form of semaglutide that's useful for diabetes, it had been on the market in the US and Canada and Europe for like 4 years before it hit approval in New Zealand. And it still took MedSafe a year and a month to approve it, even though it had already been in widespread use for years and years overseas. And it's really effective for diabetes. And we've got a lot of diabetics in New Zealand. Yeah, so that's all crazy. And it looks like it's gonna be solved. We're pretty happy.
There's a similar story in agriculture with a product called Bovaer, which has claimed to reduce methane emissions, which is what we're all after, of course, by 30%. And it's been approved in many countries around the world, and farmers overseas are using this to the best effect. But it's taking so long for it to get through, I think, the EPA, the Environmental Protection Authority here. A similar sort of example, really. Takes too long.
Well, I see this as really a beachhead that the problem isn't that New Zealand's regulators are ineffective per se. It's that we're requiring local approval for things that are already in use overseas and already proven effective overseas. Like we're spending our time reinventing wheels rather than looking at things that are unique to New Zealand and might need actual local assessment. And we don't always do this. So for new car approvals, for example, if Toyota comes up with a new model, they just have to show that it meets the relevant Japanese standards or American standards or Canadian standards or British standards. There's a list of standards that New Zealand says, yeah, if it meets one of these, it's good enough for the New Zealand roads for a new car. We're smart enough about it for cars, but we hadn't quite figured it out for medicines, except now it's getting fixed, and I'm very happy about that.
Right. Now, can we see the government making deals with cities directly that would achieve, proposing long-term city and regional infrastructure deals?
Yeah, so this has been a neat one to kind of follow. And we've seen this one in Canada as well. So there, the Canadian government picked up a lot of the really good stuff that the prior Labour government had put in its urban growth agenda, trying to free up more land, trying to get councils to have more development. But the Canadians have taken it a step further because of some of the jurisdictional issues. They're saying that the central government will give funding through the Housing Accelerator Fund to councils or cities in Canada that cut red tape for building. The version here on city deals are long-term infrastructure deals that would make it a lot easier for councils to get the kit in that would make it easier to say yes to housing, facilitate housing development. They'll have to come to some agreements with central government over it. And I think that this is one of the ways that National is hoping to avoid some of the otherwise potentially difficult issues with the removal of the medium density standards. So the prior Labour government had a rule in place that if all councils had to allow building up to three houses of up to 3 stories on normal residential lots, and National had withdrew from the bipartisan consensus on that. There'd been a lot of worries that councils would play a lot of games with what National had proposed as an alternative, where councils would be required to put up 30 years of land supply, because there are lots of ways to rort that kind of a deal. Well, if you bundle it into a city deal where central government is also going to be coming to the table on fixing up some infrastructure to make it all work, it's less likely that they play those kinds of games.
Is there anything in the agreements, the coalition agreements, which is where we started, that you're not happy with, that you don't think is going to
Oh,
work?
sure. Well, I'm not sure about not working, but there are always disappointments, right? I like looking at the things that I favor. It makes me happier to look at those, and I can worry about the other ones a little bit later on. Same when Labour was elected in 2017, I could cheer what Twyford was aiming to do in housing, and he made a lot of progress. It was great. With this one, the bits that are a little bit less good. In the New Zealand First Agreement, there's a commitment to maintaining the age of eligibility at 65. We had done a few reports looking at this, and we'd suggested that the age of eligibility could be increased and tied automatically to increases in healthy life expectancy. Now, of course, not everybody is able to continue working after age 65. So we've talked about having a transitional benefit for those unable to work after age 65 before they're eligible for New Zealand Super. It would be a health-tested benefit rather than a means-tested benefit. And it would plug that gap so that people weren't left in that lurch. Aging population means that the combination of health costs and superannuation costs for an older cohort will start dominating our long-term fiscal outlook. It's not in the best of shape, and the only way to start fixing that is dealing with some of these problems, and, well, it's being punted for at least another 3 years.
Well, Eric, great to chat as always. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts, your views, and very much appreciate it.
Thank you so much. Always fun.
Good on you. Dr. Eric Crampton, Chief Economist at New Zealand Initiative.